I posted on the wiki last night your new arch nemesis, problem set 2, which will consist of filling in some gaps in the last lecture and this upcoming one. It is definitely a difficult problem set. I'm not going to do a tutorial today in addition to the problem set so that you could use the tutorial time today to ask questions about it. And I made the due date at the end of next week. It is a long, difficult calculation, but it's one of the most famous calculations in physics, certainly one of the most famous calculations in cosmology. And from now on, when anyone asks, we don't know what happened before the Big Bang, how would we ever know? You can say, I calculated that. It was a homework problem, no big deal. Last time, I'm actually just outlining the calculation. Last time I had gotten here after switching to ADM variables and doing a little bit of canceling terms. Thanks to a question after the lecture that I had forgotten to define the symbols delta EIJ and delta E, so let me put them up. The original EIJ was this. Let me write out the whole chain of definitions. I wrote the 3 metric as A squared delta IJ plus HIJ, and then I defined EIJ to be this. This was just the intrinsic curvature times a factor of m. And E, GIJ, EIJ. I want to take the definition of delta EIJ to be if I expand EIJ in powers of the metric fluctuations, then the zeroth order term. It's easy to see, it's just HGIJ. An explicit formula for the difference is this. Likewise, delta E is E minus 3H, which is the same thing as GIJ delta EIJ. Throughout this calculation, I'm using like a 3 plus 1 dimensional notation where all geometric objects like covariant derivatives, this square root G, this Ricci scalar, are computed using the 3 metric. All indices are spatial and erased and lowered with respect to the 3 metric. Now. One thing that sort of helped me through this maze of algebra was thinking about how to get rid of terms that appear to be first order in the fluctuations. Remember, we expect those terms to all cancel because we're expanding around a solution of the background equations of motion. There appear to be some first order terms here. This delta E is a first order quantity. It involves derivatives of GIJ. And there are first order terms hiding here. So this is zeroth order. And the square root of G3, if I expand it, will look like the square root of the background metric times the trace of HIJ. So there's the term hidden in the square root G that looks sort of like trace H times V. And there's a term hiding here that looks sort of like Hubble times trace of H dot. And the way you cancel them is doing an integration by parts in time to bring the derivative off the H. You differentiate Hubble using Friedman's equations, and it will turn out to cancel this term. So that was, I thought, sort of a tricky, I'll leave that up, I guess. Tricky cancellation to see. I want to work it out. The way that I work it out in my notes, and I should probably rethink whether there's a cleaner way of presenting the step, but here's what I have in my notes, is I want to write down a magic identity. For doing integrals that look like I'll flip it to the magic identity first and then go back. For doing integrals that look like a function of time times e with a factor of square root g3. So if I plug in the definition of e here, let's say where f is any function of time, but not space. If I plug in the definition of E, I see that it's Gij times this. And the first thing to note, I think I'm missing some 1/2s here. And the first thing to note is that these terms go away because I have a 3 covariant derivative times the square root of g3. To everything here is 3. This is g3 upper ij. By the way, integration by parts works in gr. Those terms are 0. And then the remaining term can be written as, let me write it out as one more step. After staring at this for a bit, I realized that this whole mess is the time derivative of square root g3. Remember there was a formula for differentiating a determinant where you got the same determinant times the trace of g inverse g dot? If I have the square root here, the same formula works out with a factor of 1/2. That's sort of a non-obvious thing to see, but once you, I leave it to you to work through if the formula for differentiating a determinant to see that this is the case. Once you see that, then you can just integrate by parts and put the derivative on the f. A version of the magic identity that has delta E instead of E, well, they just differ by a 3H, so I would get this. This is a hard calculation, and it requires some tricks, or there's probably other ways to do it where you do less trickery and more algebra, but this is the way that I did it. So I wanted to just show the parts of the calculation that involve tricks. Okay, so going back to this action, what I'm going to try to do is apply the magic identity to this term in order to cancel this term. I have this factor of n to the minus 1 that does depend on space, not just on time. If I expand, so in the next step, I'm also going to expand n as minus 1 plus psi. In the previous lecture, I was using eta here, which was not a good notation because that meant something else in the discussion of extrinsic curvature. It also refers to one of the slow roll parameters in inflation, so we have a problem of too many etas. All right, so if I expand in powers of psi, so with this definition, the perturbation variables that we're expanding in are now psi, ni, and hij. These are the first order quantities. We want to expand the action up to second order in those variables. So if I just replace all the n's by minus 1 plus psi, and I'm just only going to expand to second order, so I could replace this n to the minus 1 by minus minus 1 minus psi, right? Because it multiplies something that's first order and up. Then I get the following. I'm not doing much in this step, just expanding in at a second order in psi. Oh, yeah, okay. So the first term, let's go through term by term. I may have some sign errors in my notes. I'll have to come back and think about this more carefully. Oh, no, I'm sorry. This is the sign error. Right, I defined n to be, I got confused for a minute because quantities like g00 and g lower z0 and g upper z0 are negative. But I defined n to be positive. So that's why this is a plus. This is 1 minus psi. It's very hard to avoid typos and minor errors the first time you make notes. So they're probably, if you think you've found typos or errors in either the notes or the problem set, you're probably right. Just send me an email so I can fix them. Okay. So that's the expansion to second order in the perturbations. A little subtlety here is that in this term, both of the, involving the Ricci scalar, both of these terms are second order. If you remember our discussion of perturbation theory, where you expand in perturbations around a background metric, we found that now, for purposes of calculating this scalar curvature R3, the background metric is flat, because the spatial background metric is a squared dx squared. And as far as a 3 observer is concerned, that's just a flat metric. This a depends on time, but not space. So it just looks like a constant when restricted to a single slice. Now, a four observer that computes the curvature, the space-time curvature of the FRW metric would see a non-zero curvature. But for purposes of this 3+1 dimensional setup, the background metric is flat, although there are powers of A which appear that can be treated as constants. So if I'm thinking about expanding in powers of a metric around a flat background, then in our discussion of perturbation theory, we found that the curvature is generally first order in the fluctuations. Either Riemann or Ricci or scalar, you get something that's first order. So you know, in this cross term, for example, there are terms that look like psi times h, second order terms. But if I integrate the curvature, say with a d3x, then this is second order in the fluctuations. There's some integration by parts that make the first order terms go away when I do this integral. And the reason that's true is because, in general, if I expand the Einstein-Hilbert action around any background metric, the first order term that appears is proportional to the Einstein tensor of the metric. And in this case, since we're expanding around a flat spatial metric, there is no Einstein tensor, and the first order term is zero. So that is a subtlety to be aware of during this calculation. Both of these terms, it sure looks like they would be different orders in perturbation theory, but both terms here are second order. One is you get terms of the form either HH or psi H. Okay. Then what I want to do is the purpose of writing this out is so that I can have a second order term times a term that I can use the magic identity on. So I want to apply the magic identity. Specialize to the case where the function of time is minus 4h. So I can do something with this term. So that gives the integral of 3x square root of g3 minus 4h delta e. What's the term I want to simplify? OD4x. By the magic identity, let me keep the m plunk squared over 2 in front. Root over 2. End up with this. That's minus f dot minus 3hf plus. All right, and then we can use Friedman's equations, which say that h squared is rho over, let's say with the m Planck squared in front, m Planck squared h squared is rho over 3, which is 1/6 phi dot squared plus 1/3 v. And the other Friedman equation says that m Planck squared m dot is minus rho plus p over 2, which is minus 1/2 phi dot squared. Plugging those in, I get square root of g3 times 2v, which is exactly what I need to cancel the zeroth order term on this side. So there are these really non-trivial tricks in the calculation, but you kind of know how to find them if you make your goal to be to get rid of all the first order terms and write the action as something that is manifestly second order. So with that cancellation, the action looks like this. On So this is kind of a this minus psi squared. So this is a nice midpoint in the calculation because this is the point in the calculation where all terms are manifestly second order. Remember in this first term that both the Einstein-Hilbert action and psi, the integral of psi times R3 are second order, even though they look like they're different orders. All right, so from here the calculation is more straightforward, and it does involve a significant amount of algebra, but not so many weird tricks. So the next step is to, I'll just summarize, a page or so of algebra, and say that the next step is to expand everything in psi to second order. So that would use, to expand the R3 to second order, we would use our results on GR perturbation theory. That would give both the Einstein-Hilbert action and just R3 itself, allow us to expand them in powers of H. Another thing that I can do is, this is a good time in the calculation to fix the gauge. We hadn't done that yet, but at some point we were planning to remove some degrees of freedom from H by assuming that it is, not assuming, but making a gauge transformation to ensure that Hij looks like this, where zeta is a trace part and gamma is a traceless symmetric tensor satisfying the gauge condition that when contracted with the derivative, you get zero. So after a bunch of algebra, you can write the result as a scalar plus a tensor piece. I don't really like this terminology, but it's standard to call. To call the piece that involves zeta the scalar action and the piece that involves gamma the tensor action. And the tensor action has a simple, nice simple form. Squared over 8 cubed gamma dot is a partial gamma. And the scalar action is still kind of a mess, and I'm going to take a minute to write it down, because when I talk about the next step, I do want to have a formula to stare at. This formula is in the problem set. That has always puzzled me about this calculation is that the starting point is so simple, the 4D action of single field slow roll inflation. And when we go through all of these steps, the gauge fixing, the ADM gauge, removing the non-dynamical degrees of freedom, etc., then the final answer is also very simple. But I don't know of any way of getting one from one to the other that doesn't involve a bunch of many line equations. I've always sort of been curious whether there's a better way to do this calculation. But this is the best way that I know of. At a certain point, you're going to get some ugly formulas that look like this. Okay, now, so we're here in the calculation. Oh, sorry. Oh, yes. Thanks. Okay. Now, the action S2 involves only the dynamical field gamma, so we're done with that and we can set it aside. The action S0 involves the dynamical field zeta, and the auxiliary fields psi, which is part of n, and ni, which are non-dynamical. If you look at this action, they appear without time derivatives. And that's expected. That always happens in the ADM formalism. So as we described before, the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion for those fields, for psi and ni, contain no time derivatives and just let you solve for psi and ni in terms of the dynamical fields. In this case, there's only one dynamical field, zeta. So what this action is telling you is that there are some constraint equations you can solve to just find psi and ni in terms of zeta. Once those equations have been solved, let me actually write down the answers. This is a part of problem set two. If you derive the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion for psi and ni and solve them, then you can find these explicit forms for n and psi. Psi is very simple, and chi is a little messier. Looks like this. Del minus 2 zeta dot. And then the next step is to just substitute those fields back into the action to get the effective action for zeta with psi and ni removed. That's always a step in general relativity, or you can do general relativity that way. You just eliminate these non-dynamical fields from the action to get the effective action for the dynamical variables. And so when you do that, and this is the last item on the problem set, you take those expressions and substitute them in and do some algebra. A little hint, and this algebra involves a lot of integration by parts. Then you end up with the action in this very compact form. So that's the end of our classical GR calculation after a lot of steps involving some, you know, algebra that's a little messy and a bunch of machinery like extrinsic curvature, Lie derivatives, etc. We can view single field inflation as a field theory with three dynamical fields. There is a scalar field zeta, and there is a field gamma which has two components. It looks like, I guess, just to count the components of gamma, gamma ij is a symmetric tensor which has, in 3D, which has six components. Its trace is zero, which reduces the number to five. And then there's this divergence identity, which has three components, so that reduces the number of degrees of freedom to two. Gamma is just, you can think of as just gravity wave degrees of freedom with two polarizations. And zeta is some scalar mode that is there because we have an inflaton. So you can view single field slow roll inflation as a field theory with a scalar quantity zeta with this action. Very simple. And a two-component field gamma with the action S2, also very simple. So that is the end of the classical calculation. And now we can talk about how you quantize a field theory with this action.
So at the end, how many degrees of freedom do we have?
Yeah, the answer is three degrees of freedom. Zeta has one, and gamma ij has two.
What about five?
Oh yeah, so that's an interesting question. In general, theories with gravity, actions with gravity, always have eight fewer degrees of freedom than you expect, because there are four gauge modes. And there are four non-dynamical fields that you can remove from the action. So in this case, it's good that you ask a question about the counting. The counting is actually pretty subtle. So the way that we initially wrote down the action, we would say the counting works like this. There are 10 degrees of freedom in g mu nu and 1 degree of freedom from phi. And then we expect to remove four gauge modes and four non-dynamical modes to end up with three. And that is what happened, but what's sort of confusing about it is that you might expect, from this way of thinking about it, you would expect the three modes to involve two modes of the metric and one mode of phi. What we seem to have ended up with is no phi and three modes of the metric. What happened is that it is a gauge. You might ask, well, if we have a scalar fluctuation, what is fluctuating? Is it components of the metric that are fluctuating, or is it phi that's fluctuating? And that sounds like it would be a well-defined question, but that's actually just a gauge-dependent question. If I have a phi fluctuation, I can always choose coordinates so that, here's some whatever phi fluctuation I want. Here's a configuration with delta phi non-zero. I can always choose coordinates so that the surfaces of constant coordinate time, of constant x0, are the surfaces of constant phi, and gauge delta phi to zero. The price that I'll pay for making that gauge transformation is that I'll move the fluctuations into components of the metric. So it would be possible to choose a different gauge for the calculation where the degrees of freedom at the end are, say, gamma ij. And indeed, the gauge that we chose for this problem are gauge conditions. We gauge the phi fluctuations to zero, and then we had three gauge conditions that involve the metric. But we could have chosen to do the whole calculation in a different gauge, where delta phi is non-zero, and you put another gauge condition on the metric. Like you could, for example, you could impose the condition that the trace of the spatial 3 metric is zero. That would be a consistent way of doing the calculation. You would get an action that looks different, and you would still have three dynamical degrees of freedom, but you would find that the other degree of freedom here was phi. Now the gauge that I chose, I think the most intuitive gauge to use would be a gauge where the scalar degree of freedom, where you gauge out four components of the metric, the scalar degree of freedom at the end of the calculation is phi. Two fluctuations in the metric, one fluctuation in phi. That would be the most intuitive gauge. That gauge actually has a name. It's called the spatially flat gauge. And it's more intuitive. The problem with it is that you do not end up with these nice expressions at the end of the calculation. You end up with a huge mess. The very first time I taught this, I tried to use the spatially flat gauge because I thought it would be more intuitive, and I just boxed myself into like an algebraic corner where the expressions were so horrendous that everyone hated it. So I learned the hard way that you want to do the calculation in this gauge where all the fluctuations are chosen by choice of gauge to be in the metric. I don't think there's any way that you'd know that in advance. It's just that this calculation is very well explored and people try it in a bunch of different gauges.
So, mean, I was just a little confused by the term you method with pi dot square. Because, I mean, maybe what will happen is that you, for example, from S0 complete the equation of motion for pi dot, and then for the one for psi, then they are not going to be independent, so.
Oh, I'm sorry, could you say that one more time?
Like I'm a little confused with the term in the metric that involves phi dot square.
Phi
dot. It looks like you can define like an equation of motion.
Oh, yeah, it's okay. So this, right. So this phi is just the background phi. It's not a dynamical quantity.
Ah.
Yes, sorry. So because I'm doing the calculation in a gauge where delta phi is 0, all expressions involving phi are just backgrounds that depend on time but not space. So for example, where, you know, because delta phi is 0, where phi dot appears, it always means the background phi. And when v appears in the equations, it always means the background v. So these are functions with explicit time dependence, but no dynamicalness. Okay. So it took me much longer than I thought to do all this classical GR. And I don't have much time to talk about the quantum mechanics, but the quantum mechanics, I think, can be done, actually be done pretty quickly. Interesting thing about this calculation is that the classical physics, the GR, is a mess, but the quantum mechanics is actually, you know, kind of pretty and non-messy. Okay, so you guys have seen in the first cosmology class a discussion of how you quantize this type of theory, but I want to sort of review it, so I'll go kind of fast. And I am a big fan of starting with like simplest model for everything. So I want to go back to Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics and just talk about the time-dependent simple harmonic oscillator. So considering the following problem, I have a harmonic oscillator in Schrodinger equation quantum mechanics with a time-dependent frequency. And I want to assume that at early times, the frequency is constant. And that at those times, the state of the system is just the quantum mechanical ground state of a harmonic oscillator with constant frequency omega naught. Then you might ask, what is the wave function at time t? Now there's a very nice way of solving this problem that doesn't involve computing any wave functions, and that is to solve it in the Heisenberg picture. The way the Heisenberg picture works is that you can Heisenbergize any operator. So if O is any operator, then the corresponding Heisenberg picture operator is defined like this. Where this U is the unitary evolution operator from some chosen initial time t0 to the time t. Now, sometimes to distinguish between operators that have been Heisenbergized and operators that have not, the S for Schrodinger subscript is used. So for example, the Hamiltonian would have Schrodinger picture operators. In the Heisenberg picture, the reason I wrote this equation down, by the way, is that sometimes in quantum mechanics classes, when the Heisenberg picture is discussed, it is assumed that the Hamiltonian is time independent, in which case this unitary evolution operator is just e to the minus ih times t minus t zero. In the case where the Hamiltonian is time dependent, the unitary evolution operator is more complicated, and the Heisenberg picture operator is just defined in terms of whatever that operator is. So a Heisenberg I is a operator without time dependence to get an operator with time dependence. In the Heisenberg picture, operators are time dependent, but the wave function never evolves. So to compute an observable, all observables in quantum mechanics are expectation values of operators. I sandwich the Heisenberg picture operator at some time t between two copies of the initial wave function. By the definition of the Heisenberg picture operator, that would be the same thing as evolving the wave function on both sides. And notice when I move the U dagger into the bra, the dagger goes away. That's the same thing as sandwiching the Schrodinger picture operator between two copies of the wave function at the time t. The unitary operator just converts psi of t0 to psi of t. This expectation value is computed in the Schrodinger and Heisenberg pictures. You just reorganize where the u's go. In the Schrodinger picture, they go on the psi's, and you think of the psi as time dependent. In the Heisenberg picture, I should put the h here. Sorry, I kind of mangled that first equation. Fixed. In the Heisenberg picture, the u's go in the operator, and the operator becomes a function of time. Heisenberg picture operators satisfy the same equations of motion as the corresponding classical variables. For example, in this problem, the equation of motion for the Heisenberg operator XH is just PH. And the Heisenberg the equation of motion for the Heisenberg picture operator P is just this. Usually you can just write those down without doing any calculation. But if you want to check, then where these equations come from are in general, the Heisenberg equation of motion is for an operator O. Is given by you take the Heisenbergized Hamiltonian and commute it with O. And in this example, so for example, if you wanted to check this equation, um, I would take, first I need to Heisenberg I as a Hamiltonian. So that just means I put H's on the P and the H. I'm actually sneaking in a not completely obvious fact, which is that if you Heisenbergize a product of operators, that's the same thing as Heisenbergizing the individual operators. So I want to commute that with X. And then if you think about that commutator, I get no commutator from this term because XH commutes with itself. And if I commute PH with XH, well, there's an identity that says that in quantum mechanics, it's always too true that the commutator of X and P is I. That's true of the Schrodinger picture operators, and it's also true of the Heisenberg picture operators, provided they're evaluated at the same time. So using that identity, when I commute P past X, I pick up a minus I. And there are two factors to commute, so I get minus 2i P here. This just gives p hat. You would want to go through these steps in, say, a more complicated situation where there was like an operator or ordering ambiguity. If there were a term in the Hamiltonian here which was something like x p squared x, where it matters how I order it, then to figure out what ordering you get in the Heisenberg equations of motion, you would want to go through and work out the commutators. But in simple examples, it suffices to just say that the Heisenberg picture equations of motion are the same as the classical equations of motion. All right. So we're going to try to solve in this example these equations of motion for the operators. And we want to think about the initial conditions. Times we're just assuming that the system is a harmonic oscillator with a time-independent frequency, which is a familiar system where we know how to compute everything. And in particular, it's easy to show that when the frequency is constant, that the Heisenberg equation of motion is just this. So the a hat gets e to the minus I. This equation without the time dependence is just the usual relation in all the quantum mechanics books. This should be a minus. Between xp and the ladder operators. And then when I Heisenbergize a ladder operator, it just gets either e to the minus I omega t or e to the I plus I omega t. So this is easy. I didn't work this out in detail, but this is easy to show. Okay. Now let's think about, in the Heisenberg picture, what would happen if we started at early times with these operators, and then we evolve them forward in time using the Heisenberg picture equation of motion. So one thing that's easy to see, and this is why the Heisenberg picture is so powerful for this problem. Is that when I have all the equations of motion, then I'll always get something which is a linear combination of A and A dagger. Let me just write the most general linear combination down and then talk about what the coefficients are. Let me write this as F. Let's see. Yeah, fine. Why is that? Well, at early times, before I start changing the frequency, X and P are just X and P Heisenberg are these particular time-dependent linear combinations of A and A dagger. And then when I do start varying the frequency, then I just get time derivatives that say I get equations of motion that say when I step forward a little bit in time, X and P just change by some linear combination of the old X and the old P. And that can never generate any operator that's outside of this basis. I'll just keep getting linear combinations of A and A dagger, but with coefficients whose time dependence I don't know yet. So to start constraining these functions, a nice way to do it is to say that, first off, I know that V must be U star, and G must be F star, because the Heisenberg picture operators are always Hermitian. There's more than one way to start solving for these mode functions. I'll just tell you how I did it. So first I said, well, I know that at any time the Heisenberg picture operators are Hermitian operators. That had better be true if the Heisenberg picture is going to make sense. And it follows formally, it follows immediately from the definition of the Heisenberg picture operator plus the fact that the Schrodinger picture operator is Hermitian. So I'll say this is true because X Heisenberg and P Heisenberg are Hermitian. And then, so I'll write X Heisenberg is U A Schrodinger plus U star A dagger. Similarly for P. Now I want to start using the Heisenberg picture equations of motion to relate these guys to each other. So the first equation of motion says that because x dot is p, that means f must be u dot. X Heisenberg is p Heisenberg. So if I put that in, and then the last equation is the Heisenberg equation of motion for p hat, which tells me that U double dot is minus omega squared u. In other words, u, the only function left, just satisfies the classical equation of motion. The initial condition I can read off from this says that at early times when the harmonic oscillator is time independent, that U of t has this form. So it's a pure, it's the pure negative frequency solution. I don't have any e to the I omega naught t term. The pure negative frequency-ness of the mode function really in the, just encodes the fact that the system starts in its vacuum state. This normalization is trickier to get. That comes out of, you know, the details of how you relate the ladder operators to X and P. Okay. So I claim that this is the solution to the problem. This is the, if this were a quantum field theory, we'd say that this is the solution of the theory. I have expressed the Heisenberg picture operators in terms of a mode function that I can find by integrating a classical differential equation. And to convince you that that deserves to be called the solution of the theory, you can calculate any expectation value. At any time. For example, suppose I want to calculate the expectation value of x hat at time t. So in the Heisenberg picture, x hat squared. The expectation of x hat would be 0 by the x to minus x symmetry. So in the Heisenberg picture, the way you calculate that expectation value is you take the initial wave function. You say the wave function never evolved, but my operator evolved. I want to take the Heisenberg picture operator at time t. Because I assume that the system started at its ground state, this initial wave function is just the, you know, zero ground state of a harmonic oscillator. And the x squared is equal to u a plus u star a dagger. Let me write out two factors. To calculate this, I can observe that a annihilates the ground state. Annihilates the ket and can be taken to 0. And the Hermitian conjugate of that statement is that if a dagger appears next to a bra, it also annihilates the blot, the bra. You could also compute this. So in this example, that's enough to deduce that the answer is u star. Let me write out the time dependence, u of t star, times 0, a dagger a, 0, which is equal to 1. If I had a more complicated example, like say x hat to the fourth, I could still compute this expectation value. It's just some harmonic oscillator expectation value, so it's always computable. And a convenient way to compute it would be to just remember that a dagger is equal to 1, and commute all the A's past the A dagger until they annihilate the ket. I forgot to, sometimes I forget to put all the subscripts. So I remembered the H over here, but I forgot the Schrodinger. If I forget, hopefully it'll be apparent from context. So this expectation value is telling you like how the spread of the wave function evolves. It shows that the width of the wave function, its characteristic width, is just equal to the absolute value of the mode function. Okay. That's basically all I have to say about the quantum mechanics case. Next time we're gonna, I can't resist making a few more comments, but I'll save them for next time. We'll talk about the generalization of this Heisenberg picture calculation to a field theory such as single field silver inflation. Thanks.